It is with great pleasure that I introduce Douglas Hunter, who, reading from the script here, is a filmmaker, freelance post-production supervisor, et cetera, et cetera. So you went to film school at USC.
Correct.
Which is, along with NYU, one of the two best schools, depending on whether you're on the East Coast or West Coast, one is better than the other. But they're bloody awesome places to have been. And so I'm actually hoping you'll introduce yourself a bit more, since most people I've met from USC Film School have some depth of background that are very interesting. Okay, and post-structural film theory to the kinesiology of rock climbing. A range of interests which is baffling, if not downright blinding. So I think this is going to be a great session, and will be even better once I am quiet, which is about right now. Please.
Great, thanks. Well, let me just say a couple opening remarks about me and the film. First of all, there's a little ambiguity. I am a member of the church. I got a couple questions in the hallway. Like, so are you a Mormon? Yes, I am a Mormon. And the reason I'm here as asked to present was that I actually started, I know people are probably thinking in terms of Proposition 8 and that sort of thing. I started making this film in 2007. So I was personally have been very interested in the dynamic between a couple things. One, religion and sexuality, and then also I saw making the film as very much a theological expression of my interest in the theme of how we engage the other, and specifically in the Old Testament and through the work of scholars such as Emmanuel Levinas and Walter Brueggemann. You know, so this is like a very important theme to me. And then I saw a call, there was a call for films, a friend of mine was doing an international documentary project on the theme of citizenship, and I thought, well, this might just be the place and to try something. And I didn't set out to make a film about a lesbian priest, but I was interested in, you know, the dynamic between religion and sexuality, and by doing research and Googling and that sort of thing, I discovered in my own town, my own backyard, Susan Russell, who lives just a few miles from me, incredibly articulate, great singing voice, wonderful theologian, a rising star in the Episcopal Church, great personal story, but not such a huge rising star that she wouldn't deal with me. So, and then, of course, the real reason I got to present here was because in February, there was a front page article in the LA Times about Susan and I in the process of making this film, and that's where things got really interesting, because then, you know, across the country, there I was outed as a No-on-8 Mormon. and I hadn't been hiding, but I had spoken in front of television cameras, and I was a media spokesperson for Faith Equality California during the Prop 8 thing. But that article generated a lot of interest in the film and in me and in Susan, so that's how I got to be here. A little bit about the film. It's very much a duct tape and baling twine kind of project. I funded it out of my own pocket, largely with the royalties I earned on a book I wrote about rock climbing. and literally, post-production studios were my living room. where else do I want to go? So that's kind of the introduction. I mean, I think that we can have it. I always look forward to these discussions. I'm not really sure what to expect from this audience. I usually know what to expect from an audience. I'm not sure what we'll be talking about. So I think that'll be fun. But typically, I've had wonderful discussions with people after the film. And I do think that in the Mormon context, it raises a number of really interesting questions, especially in the context of the film we saw earlier today, Nobody Knows, where there was a lot of discussion about inclusiveness and where, you know, the problems with a exclusive type of theology, that sort of thing. So I'll just I'll leave it at that. If we could turn off the lights,
I'll hit the space bar and hopefully we'll have a film. Can we turn off the small?
Yeah.
I just didn't quite watch it.
Martin. ever asked me to imagine one of the many things I might end up doing, I could never have imagined that I would end up an Episcopal priest. And yet, what a responsibility those of us who have this platform of privilege and this freedom to speak the truth of our relationships, of our lives, of our experience of community, in order that others might see and understand that our truth has value. There was a time in the church when we supported segregation and slavery even. There have been times when women were not lifted up into full leadership or even provided with full access to all the sacraments. At the moment, it's the gay and lesbian folk who are the scapegoats in some ways. We have our own stories, our own experiences, and they are there to strengthen the fabric of the whole community if we can embrace them, if we can claim them, if we can include them.
How are you today? Good to see you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Yeah, I had
well
find myself.
Growing up, the church was an important part of our life. My father was an Episcopalian and my mother was Lutheran, which didn't necessarily mean they needed to go. It was more the drop us off for Sunday school, and then they pick us up later and we go to Sunday brunch. Right out of college, I went to work at a bank, met the man who would become my husband, and then got very busy being a young wife, and before too long, a mother of two. During that period of time, church just wasn't a priority. It just wasn't something I thought about a lot. Pretty much settled into a privileged upper middle class life where I stayed home with my children and my husband went off to work and played tennis and sailed a boat. As my kids got a little bit older, I was continuing, life as usual at home. And yeah, I was starting to have this sort of internal agitation. I'd always sort of thought eventually I would go back to graduate school when my kids were older, back to law school, or maybe for a graduate degree in history, which was my undergrad degree. But with no external reasons for feeling that agitation, I started to feel very clearly internally called to, I needed to make change, I needed to make a decision, and I didn't know what that was about. So the moment I can point to was I was driving on a beautiful October day. See the Channel Islands out in the Pacific Ocean, and I had the Golden Retriever and both of my kids and their cousins in the back. I had this sense that I had everything I ever wanted, this really blessed life. And then I had this imploding thought in my head that didn't come from me, and the thought was, is that enough? I look back on that moment as the beginning of my spiritual U-turn. It wasn't dramatic, there were no wheels squealing. But it was the moment when I started to explore the question for myself, is it enough? And all of a sudden, I wanted to be doing something that made a difference, and I wasn't sure what that was. We're called to do justice. Our call is to engage the issues of the day as Jesus engaged the issues of his. And Jesus didn't just talk about prayer and individual salvation. In fact, Jesus talked about that a whole lot less than Jesus talked about being peacemakers and about giving to others so that we could all live. And as we live that out in the church today, we do find ourselves advocating around issues that draw us into the public arena. A prior presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church, John Hines, famously said that justice is the corporate face of God's love. So for me, when I go out to advocate on issues of peace and justice and inclusion, the impact may be political, but the motivation is profoundly theological. By the time I was getting more active in the church, we had women priests, but I've never actually met one yet. So my only vision of what clergy looked like were men. Was very clear that a woman in that role felt weird. When it came down to it, if I wanted a priest, I wanted a real one. I was invited to go away on a renewal weekend. One of the spiritual directors on the weekend was a woman priest. And what I remember was going away on that weekend being a little condescendingly open to the experience. Still not convinced that, you know, women clergy were necessarily my cup of tea, but, you know, well, there'd be one. It was sort of like going to the zoo. And then I heard her speak. I was just extraordinarily touched by her message and her demeanor and her faithfulness. And I remember being aware, cognitively aware, that when she said amen and sat down, that it was the first time I'd ever been sorry a preacher had quit preaching because I wanted to hear more. And I walked back to my room, you know, in the dark, already thinking, you know, I'm going to have to re-examine my whole opinion on this women's ordination thing, because, wow, she was really something.
Those of us who advocate for full inclusion in the church are sometimes accused of abandoning the faith or undermining the tradition, and the argument I want to make is directly contrary to that. I believe we're actually claiming the tradition. And the story I used to illustrate that is of one of Jesus himself, who in the temple was confronted by a lawyer trying to trap Jesus, asked him, which is the greatest commandment? And Jesus' response was, the greatest commandment is this, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind, and the second is like unto it, love your neighbor as yourself. On these two hang all the law and the prophets. That's the tradition I claim. That the litmus test, the lens through which I look at all of the law and the prophets, and in fact all of the Holy Scripture, is, does it serve loving God, and does it serve my ability to love my neighbor as myself?
So I found myself one day calling Liz, the woman whose sermon had changed my mind about women in the priesthood. It was a big thing to call her, but I called her anyway, and I said, maybe sometime, like, if she didn't have anything better to do, maybe eventually, there was no rush, you know, that we might, like, get together and talk sometime. She just laughed and said, if she had Friday morning available, that I'd get away and have breakfast. So I said, okay, yeah, sure. And I remember hanging up the phone thinking, what on earth am I going to say to this woman now? So she came and went for breakfast, and she was wonderful and really patient and listened to me talk for a really long time about, you know, what I'm supposed to do and feeling like I need to make a decision. And finally she just stopped me and said, I want you just for a minute to consider the possibility that maybe what you're dealing with is a call to ordain ministry. And I mean, I literally could have fallen out of the booth at the coffee shop. It just had never occurred to me that's what this was about.
I think the absolute truth is that God loves us all and calls us to love one another. And that's it. And I think all the rest is, in some ways, tools we found to live that out. The challenge gets to be that the tools we've created to do the work can become the weapons that we use to try to inflict our truth on someone else, rather than trying to find, build bridges and find where do those truths connect. And I think that's different than being a relativist. I don't think all things are relative. I don't think oppression and marginalization and bigotry are part of God's plan for any of our lives, or for our politics or our theologies or our churches.
So after a process that took about 6 years, on June 1st, 1996, I was ordained a deacon. About a month later, went off to a conference. It was the first time it slowed down in 3 years. My marriage was not in great shape, and the more I got involved in the spiritual journey, the more the places of our disconnections became more obvious. One of the people I met at the conference was a church musician, but we found ourselves having a lot in common, and found ourselves sort of in the off time or the leisure time, walking around the grounds and talking about our lives. And she was going through similar problems with a long-term relationship. One of the differences was she was in a same-sex relationship. She asked me at one point, she'd never really connected with a straight woman with quite the same level of intimacy and ease. And, you know, was I sure I wasn't gay? And I said, I'm sure I'm not gay. And I had this deep sense of shame. And I found myself obsessed with that question. Why have you never entertained the possibility that maybe that might be true for you?
you know, is there something inherently wrong about being gay? And so I spent what I describe as a long night of the soul, and a lot of soul searching, and a lot of thinking through relationships, and looking at who I spend my time with, where I get my energy from, how do I self-select, you know, what feeds me, and all of the pieces in my own marriage that didn't seem to be working were all of those kind of emotional intimacy connections that I never really had with a man. The next day, the whole group of us went down to the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. It was a beautiful service, and the music, the organ was amazing. And it was during that service that I had one of those angels on the bedpost experiences where I heard that voice in my head again. And the statement I heard was, "This is how I made you. Now I need you to go back and be the priest I made you to be." I literally looked around to see if anybody else had heard that. I walked out of that service sort of almost ontologically changed. It was just really clear to me that my life didn't look like what I thought it did. So for me, the coming out experience really had nothing to do with a sexual act or even a relationship or a person. It was about really finally understanding my fullest, deepest self and getting all the pieces in place. I did, very shortly after that, talk to my husband and say, you know, I think this is what I know about myself. And he actually allowed us how he wasn't surprised. I think in a certain sense, there may have even been a little bit of a relief that the could attribute the problems in the marriage to something that he had no control over. I wonder if my husband and I wouldn't have lived sort of increasingly far apart, parallel lives. I mean, nobody would have died, but I don't think anyone would have fully lived either.
Just as I am without one plea, but that thy blood was shed for me, and that thou bidst me come to thee, O Lamb of God, I come, I come. Just as I am, though tossed about with many a conflict, many a doubt, fightings and fears within, without, O Lamb of God, I come, I come.
When I saw in print for the first time lesbian priest Susan Russell, I do remember being shocked, because that just wasn't how I thought of myself. It was a bit of an awakening. That was how I was going to be known. One of the stories about that time was we passed a resolution which was a big step forward for the blessing of same-sex unions. It didn't go as far as we hoped it would, but it was clearly a statement of the church moving ahead on this issue. And when asked by a reporter you know, how I felt about it, even though it had fallen short of what we'd asked for, the quote I remember giving was, "It wasn't the whole enchilada, but it had enough guacamole for me." And it was one of those little sound bites that got picked up, and it was all over the AP, and, you know, my mother saw it in Minnesota, and it was kind of coming out in a different way. And I was a little concerned about how my parish would respond to that, because that sort of culture of, we don't want to, like, draw a lot of attention to ourselves. And when I came home, and there in my office, in my desk, was a big gift basket full of chips and guacamole mix, I thought, you know, this is going to be okay. So that was my sort of growing into a role I hadn't really asked for. You know, I hadn't gone off thinking, okay, I'm now going to become just a big activist.
What gay and lesbian people bring into the community is an examined sexuality, and therefore the values that make up a relationship are what we talk about. We talk about monogamy. We talk about fidelity. We talk about mutual respect. We talk about a holy love that call each other into our full stature and our life in Christ. It's a great gift to the church, I believe, and to heterosexual relationships, to find that we're spending our energy talking about the values that make up a marriage, not just about the gender that make up the partners in it.
In terms of being, you know, attacked, I mean, I get a lot of that. Most of it's by email, occasional voicemail, and there are some certain conservative bloggers who love to monitor everything I write and tear it apart. Early on, when I was in my second congregation, I had a parishioner come in, someone I knew pretty well, came and was really concerned about this whole gay thing. And he said, "I just have to tell you, just the idea of a gay couple standing in the spot where my wife and I pledged our lives to each other in my church makes me sick to my stomach. Nothing personal. What I wanted to say was, how the hell do I not take that personally when it comes from someone you know who's so unthinking that his gut level ick factor is so dominating that he can't even hear that in, you know, saying that, he's basically saying, I can grant you the same level of humanity that I grant my wife and myself. But what I try to remember is that the source of that anger is fear. And I recognize that the good news I have to offer is extraordinary good news to people hearing to hear it, and it can also feel like an attack to those from whom it undermines their sense of what's right. Theologically, where I would love to see this go is if we really could get to the point where we understand sexual orientation to be morally neutral, and the question is not, you know, who do you love, but do you love?
The love that calls us all into being is so much greater than any of the differences that divide us, and I believe is the bridge across differences of theologies and cultures and concepts and politics even, that we have the opportunity to build bridges by living out that love and calling people into true community, not just into a club. You know, Jesus didn't live and die and rise again for us to create a club that we could keep other people out of. That, as from my reading, is completely antithetical to the teachings and the life and the journey of Jesus, the one who called all people to the table, for whom there were no outcasts. We pray every time we pray the Lord's Prayer, thy kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. And that kingdom come looks like a place where there are no strangers, where there are no outcasts, where there is no one left at the gate. Doubt is not the opposite of faith. Fear is. Fear is what can immobilize us and keep us from moving ahead into God's future. And when I think about all the changes in my life, I don't want to see change. And yet, everything in life is constant change. One of my favorite Bible stories is Mary Magdalene encountering Jesus in the garden. She recognizes him and tries to cling to him. And he immediately says, "You cannot cling to me, because I'm not yet ascended to the Father." And that idea that we want to cling to what we know, to hold on to it. I mean, Jesus said to the disciples, you know, I'm telling you what you can bear now. There are things that you will know differently. And I think that's where we're journeying, into a place where we do know things differently now than those who wrote the canon of the Scripture. It doesn't mean those words are dead. It means they continue to live in us as we continue to live them out in our lives. It's a constant process of changing.
Thanks. Who wants to start us off?
When is the first presidency and Quorum of the Twelve?
My suspicion is never.
I don't think that too. I wouldn't get up to. It was very beautiful. Thank you.
Well, thanks. So far, the farthest, the deepest I've gone into Utah with the film is that it actually was screened at the BYU Law School 2 weeks ago. So that was.
How did they receive?
Well, it was challenging. You know, I mean, there's some people in the room that it was a very good event. I mean, everyone spoke honestly afterwards and from really truthful, honest places. And some people were really challenged by the theology and the message of the film. Other people embraced it. The thing that I thought was most interesting about that screening was that, and I was not aware that this was going to happen, but there are actually a number of people in the room who were really empathetic to their gay friends and family members, and really believed in equality and inclusiveness, but also felt that they absolutely had to toe the official line of the church in all ways, shapes, and forms, and they're very conflicted. I mean, there's one young man who, after the screening, talked for several minutes, and he was visibly shaking by this contrast, that wanting to be inclusive and embracing of his gay family members, and also feeling that, like, you know, we have to follow the letter of the law that's laid down by the institutional church. So it was quite an interesting event, actually.
I'm a BYU Law School graduate. How did you get that movie in
there? The American Constitution Society spies got me in. The infiltrators.
Were there a faculty sponsor?
There was, yeah.
Was this a subversive group there?
No, you see, a friend of mine, Stuart Mitchell, from my ward in Pasadena, went to... is now enrolled at BYU Law School, and he saw the film and liked it, and he thought after the type of dialogue that they were having around Prop 8 in the lead up to the election that it would be good to bring it in. And he had gotten sort of a lukewarm reception from his professors, and then the article came out and he got a phone call that said, "So, have you arranged a screening yet?" So that's how it happened, and then of course they had to run it past several deans to make sure that it was going to be okay. They weren't allowed to advertise the event outside of the law school. We couldn't record it or take pictures or anything like that. So there are a few caveats in having it down there, but it was still a great event.
So when you say the article, there was some article in
LA Times ran a fairly good sized article about the film.
What I like is that it doesn't really connect so much with Prop 8. I mean, it could be, you can see it almost any time. There's a few, politically specific connections, but just the arc of this woman's life. How did you develop it with conversations with her? Or how did you know the film, what kind of shape it would take when you started out?
How did I know what kind of shape it would take when I started out? I'm not that good of a filmmaker, man. I didn't. You know, for me, filmmaking is, I often will make a film to explore something. So what we did was, first I contacted her via email and got a meeting with her, and then I pitched the idea to her, and she, a few days later, agreed to it. And the first thing we did was we did a 3-hour sit-down audio-only interview. Since it was shot on film, and I had such limited funds, I couldn't sit her down in front of the camera and do a 3-hour interview on film, because that would have been thousands and thousands of dollars. So I divided it up. I did a 3-hour sit-down interview with her. I did a radio cut of that, and then, which means we just edited the audio, broke it out into rough areas, and said, okay, this is what we probably need to cover on camera. And then that sort of dictated the structure of the film from there, you know. But yeah, I didn't know how it was gonna, what form it was gonna take until we were in there.
Did you intentionally want to be making a documentary about a lesbian minister? Is that?
No, I was attracted to the story because, look, I mean, her story is one of really interesting and profound changes, right? I mean, she started out in self-described cultural Christian. She becomes a priest. You know, she's a heterosexual soccer mom with two kids. She becomes a lesbian. She and not only that, but she's like kind of a stay-at-home mom, and now she travels literally all over the world within the Episcopalian community and also advocating for gay rights and also human rights around the world. So she's had these really remarkable transformations in her life, and also the way these transformations took place. I mean, the fact that her sexuality is directly tied to her becoming a priest is fascinating and really challenging for a lot of people.
The way she describes.
What's that?
Her transformations are revelatory.
Absolutely. Absolutely revelatory, yeah. So,
so what did you think when you heard her stories as a woman? Would she say she got told her?
I was like, I got to make a film about this. That, you know, honestly, because that's what I mean.
You know what it is.
Well, you know, I mean, I well, but I mean, that was my response because I wanted people to deal with that, to deal with the challenge of a woman in the clergy and a gay person in the clergy saying that I have a direct revelatory experience of the divine and it's shaping my life and I'm going out in the world to make the world a better place based on that. I wanted to get that out there and see what, you know, see what the response was. I mean, my theological response was less concerned than other Mormons might be, you know, you might say. I was just fascinated by her and his.
I think the point of this question is recognition that this thing is going to be profoundly disturbing to the paradigm of about 98% of the culture of Mormons. Because it so fundamentally challenges so much of what we just assume within the LDS theological framework to be a question of truth. And I think he was hoping he would give him a little bit.
Yeah, well, you know, I do want to go to the point, I guess one of my big points, especially like when I was presenting at BYU, and also in my own journey, is about how we approach the other, and are we capable of truly ethical listening? Are we able to let the other tell their own stories? Are we able to let the other describe their own experiences? Are we able to take those stories as truthful and real, or do we allow our theology to create suspicion of the other and perceive the other as a threat? And I think those are the kinds of things that I was most concerned with and most interested in and learning more about when I was putting the film together. You know.
How has she changed you?
Well, she changed me in a pretty important way. Her coming out story, she talks about how she wasn't in a relationship with somebody. You know, it was about discovering her fullest, deepest self. And through other conversations and things that didn't make it into the film, her emphasis about her sexuality was, you know, who does she have emotionally intimate relationships with? Who does she have the most spiritually intimate relationships with? Who does she trust the most? Who is she willing to be vulnerable with? These were the things that she foregrounded in her own description of her sexuality and her story of coming out. And, you know, when you're editing a film, especially like this where you're shooting it in piecemeal and then you edit for a while, then you go back and shoot some more, I mean, I'm living with these words over and over and over again, and they sank in. And there was just this day where I was like, you know, this is really my own best description of my relationship with my wife. You know, and that's where I had a kind of a more fundamental change than just being sort of a progressive Mormon but kind of a fence sitter when it came to gay rights and that sort of thing. When I really saw her experience as directly mirroring my own best hopes for my relationship. So I quickly became, after that realization, I sort of decided I better buck up and be a better husband. But also it meant that I couldn't be silent. Like when, at this point now, you know, when Prop 8 came along, then there was what was the Prop 22 question for me. Like my wife and I had just moved to California when Prop 22 happened, and we were uncomfortable with it, but it's like we didn't have a dog in the fight, so, you know, whatever. We were quiet, we never said anything to anyone about it, you know, and just went on with things. But this time around, with Prop 8, and after having forged this relationship with Susan, after hearing her own description of her life, and seeing as how her description of her sexuality was so reflexive of my sexuality, it became impossible to remain silent. And it also became an awareness on my part that if we're cutting people off from marriage, and this is their emotional and spiritual understanding of their relationship, we're cutting them off from much more than just a title, you know. So that did definitely lead to my involvement with the No on Eight campaign. You know.
Talk a bit more about your involvement.
You know, Susan is kind of a very well known figure, and has a lot of connections. And I got some phone calls, and they were like, and basically I was invited to talk about the film, and to be a media spokesperson for California. Equality California, the faith branch of that. So I went through their media training, and Susan and I did interviews together about the film primarily, and also about Prop 8. The biggest event that I participated in was an interfaith service at St. John the Divine's Cathedral in downtown Los Angeles the Saturday before the election. And I had just gotten this, you know, all these things, they just come a phone call a couple days beforehand, they're like, hey, can you come and be at this event? And you don't really know what it is. And I got there, and it's a cathedral that seats about 1,000 people, and it was full all the way to the back. There were television cameras set up all over the church. And then they're like, and then the thing is, I met my rep, you know, my contact person, and they, you know, they vet all the talks, right? And she gutted it. She's like, you're not enough on point. It's like, here's a pad, you know. She's like, here's what you can't say, here's what you can't say. Can you make this work? I'm like, all right, give me, you know, it's like 15 minutes before we're supposed to line up. I'm like, all right, I'm going to totally rewrite my talk now. Luckily, it was only a 2 or 3 minute thing. But I didn't really know how big of a deal it was until they started lining us up to proceed into the cathedral, and standing immediately in front of me was Martin Sheen. and standing and paired with him, he's standing with Rabbi Alan Freeling, who's the executive chairman of the Los Angeles, the mayor's office human relations committee. Then I really got nervous, you know. But that turned out to be it turned out to be a wonderful event, and part of the text from that talk made it into the LA Times article. And it was a purifying event, and I'll tell you why. It's one thing to have an opinion and to hold it to yourself, but when you have to go up and stand in front of 1,000 people, when you have to stand in front of the television cameras and the reporters, it's a very purifying moment. And what I discovered is that a lot of what I was thinking about and discussing just went away, and that really it came down to the core. Like, I really see this whole thing as theological, and it really came down to these theological essential components of empathy, of compassion, of respecting and approaching the other in a way that allows them to tell their own stories and to represent their own lives. And that's, you know, basically what I said to the audience, and that's why I wasn't able to support Prop 8, was because of those essential theological values.
Mine has more to do with just the filmmaking aspect of it. More and more, they're getting away in documentary films from talking heads only to when you have dramatization in this.
Yeah.
And I have mixed feelings about that. I mean, it does keep you involved, and it illustrates the story, but there's a part of me that it's like it's not her. You know, it's
fabricated.
Yeah, it's. I have mixed feelings about it. I mean, just from a documentary, you know, purely a technical point of view. I know you don't want to just sit there and listen to her. I mean, I want to listen to her, actually. I always tell people, I grew up Mormon, I can sit through anything. For the longest time. But, you know what I'm saying? In other words,
well, remember the structure.
It engages, but for me it also...
It so much depends, I think, like, I've heard this type of comment before, and, like, it seems like the people who know Susan say that the actress I had, like, personal friends of Susan come up to me after screenings and go, and that actress even looks like a young Susan. And then other people are like, it took me out. You know, I've heard that one or two times. But, you know, I had limited, like, none of every time you see B-roll is because I didn't have anything of her sitting down talking. Because of that, it's strictly, remember I said at the beginning, it's a baling twine and duct tape film.
So follow up to that. This is a technique that I have only noticed for the past 10 or 20 years. I don't watch documentaries as my major hobby. But it's something I saw, like, this started to see like 10 or 20 years ago on History Channel or something, where they have these reenactments as part of a standard fare documentaries. Yeah. Is that just a state of the art? Is it widely accepted? It's what we're doing nowadays?
I don't know. I don't think so. I think there's. It's just a decision. I think it's an aesthetic decision and a decision based on your resources and what your hopes are. You know, I wanted to get. I mean, with the reenactments, my hope was I wanted to get us back with her in that moment in time. That's what's going on. Wait, I have another question over here, and then.
I was just going to say, just real quick. I think we started seeing a lot of that with Ken Burns and Civil War documentary.
I mean, Nanook of the North was, you know, for one of the earliest best-known documentaries that had a lot of reenactments in it.
Away from reenactments.
Sure.
I'm hearing a lot of Levinas.
What's that?
I'm hearing a lot of Levinas from you.
Yeah.
Emmanuel Levinas, the French-Lithuanian philosopher, the face of the other calls us to responsibility. And I'm actually stuck at the BYU question right now because I teach there. And I have a young man who's a dear friend who's a missionary in the Congo right now who has decided he wants to go to BYU Law School and said, Mark, can I start a human rights club at the law school? Can you find out if I can start something like that? He's been a real activist, and he's an older kid. He's 25 for a missionary. And just hearing this now, I'm thinking, are you going to be able to do this young man? Are you going to be able to do this? Can we train our people in Levinasian thought, in the kind of thought that really should call us to responsibility, where we do stand up for the other and we don't allow the Nazis or whoever to come and fill the trucks with our neighbors? Or are we putting a little barrier there where you have to go through several layers to get permission to show something that really should just move people to greater responsibility, moral and ethical responsibility.
Right, and that sense of Levinas's sense of responsibility is so moving and so powerful, and it's so central to both the Hebrew and the Christian tradition. And that, you know, it may be, you know, this is a discussion that needs to be had more and more in the church, but, you know, why isn't our responsibility for the other more a part of Mormon theology, especially when we consider our own history? And why isn't social justice or economic justice more a part of our theology? Again, when we consider our own history.
We embellish our history. But, you know, even without that, mm-hmm. just because we are called to Christ.
Yeah, well, absolutely,
you know,
sure.
That should be enough. And if we are manipulators between ourselves and that call, we're in trouble.
Well, you're preaching to the choir over here. Yeah, but that was one of the interesting things about Prop 8 that I think that some of these BYU students felt, was that they did feel that call to be responsible for the other. I know I certainly did, but it's like you had to choose only one certain aspect of your theological tradition and teaching during Prop 8, and I think that's one of the things that made it so uncomfortable. You know, that there wasn't a good... Because, I mean, I know in my ward, there was a lot of bad talk of closing the ranks. A lot of military metaphors were used. You know, onward Christian soldiers was sung over and over again. and that sort of thing. And, you know, and the picture that was painted of the other was as a threat to the self. And obviously, like, that's a complete antithesis of both Levinas's work, but more importantly, you know, something like the Sermon on the Mount, right? So, I'm not sure where I'm going with all that, but go ahead.
I'll stand and ask you. Okay. Has there been numbers evaluated, or does anybody know? What I heard was up until the statement came out about for Prop 8, do everything you can to help support this measure, that there were a lot of, Latter-day Saints that were like, well, you know, doesn't hurt me, of course. And why would I vote for that? You know, and that there, up until, you know, Thomas Swanson came out and said, go and do that, people weren't going to do that.
You know, I don't know, because there was, it wasn't, at least in my neck of the woods, it wasn't really being discussed. You know, there wasn't much of a dialogue on it. I do know that, the one thing is that, on a related point, you know, going into Prop 8 in the summer, the polling numbers were dead even, right? It was like 43-43. So both sides knew going in that it was really just about talking about the movable middle. When I went, when I was working with Faith Equality California, it was all about the movable middle and what they're, you know, and I could tell. What's interesting is if you have the talking points of one side and you study them and you know them and you listen to the talk of the other side politically, you're like, oh, I know what their pollsters are telling them, you know, it gives you good insight. But it was really deadlocked until the fear-based advertising came out. And then that's when there's, you know, that when the Gavin, the famous Gavin Newsom ad came out, which is, you know, absolutely brilliant ad. You know, and that then that shifted it. And you know, we hear a lot of talk about, you know, the will of the people, but I continue to insist that no matter which way the Prop 8 vote went, there was no will of the people. It was just which side did the best moving the middle. The middle folks. Yeah.
Best marketing.
You would.
How did you?
Go ahead.
Go ahead. I want to know how you felt about the No One Aid ad with the missionaries. Yeah.
Oh, that from the Yeah, wasn't that odd? You know, there was that, and but I'll tell you the thing, that was really a moment of conflict, but the big moment of conflict for me was when there were all the protests outside the temple in Santa Monica. Because I was working very close to there, you know, and traffic was all snarled in that neck of the woods. And like here, it was really an interesting moment because there was so much anger and outrage. In the gay community, and what a lot of people didn't know is that anger and outrage, a lot of that was actually directed towards more towards the people, the faith equality people, who ran the campaign and closed the ranks and didn't let other messages out that people wanted to get out. I think that was a big cause of the anger, at least in Los Angeles after Prop 8. But boy, that image of people, you know, marching around the temple was so challenging because the anger was real, but there was no way for the mass quantity of Mormons to understand that image or to process it as anything other than aha, we're being persecuted. You know, which I thought was really tragic. And there's actually people now working on. There's a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff going on right now to prevent that sort of thing from happening when the Supreme Court gives its decision in the next 80 days at this point. Go ahead.
I was with it was like Friday night after. There was a big march in San Francisco. It ended up being about 10,000 people or so. And so I was walking behind a guy who had come up with a poster that had stylized picture of Thomas Monson, and then it said Thomas Monson, the new face of hate.
Mm-hmm.
And there were guys, there was one guy with a t-shirt, and on the back it said, Ramoni sucks and blows. And there was just a lot of, you know, enmity.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And there was one guy that I, as I was, you know, walking around, I saw him, and he had a sign that, you know, said gay and LDS. And I thought, I just want to kind of keep close to him because I want to make sure nothing happens.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there was just so much emotion in the gay community. And, you know, I mean, we did fund a whole lot of the propaganda that really wasn't all that truthful about, oh, they're going to teach your kids how to have homosexual sex in kindergarten. I mean, that's what people ended up thinking. some of the ads and whatever. So I thought that their anger was very justified, and when they were at the LDS temple, it really made sense to me.
But the thing is, it's like it was so antagonistic to so many other people, you know. Like one of the things that's really come out, like that
I've been able. There were a lot of people that said, "Gee, had I known," as at least some folk quote that I heard, and, Mormons are saying, "Gee, had I known that what I had done had hurt you so much, I might not have done."
I've heard that comment a couple other times as well. But not to make this exclusively about the aftermath of Prop 8, but I will say that. Now what I'm experiencing in the invitations that I'm getting to speak and to screen the film is that we are definitely in a period where there is the opportunity for dialogue, real dialogue, not just dialogue where both sides try to convince the other that they're right, but real dialogue where you go in without an agenda and people just listen and get to know one another better. We're definitely in that moment, and there are definitely people working, like for example with the LA mayor's office, trying, and also I know in San Francisco and other places, really trying to have honest communication between the different communities, just so that people can understand one another, because it's clear that there's so little understanding on both sides, that's not the one-way street.
I think I had a word this, and as far as understanding, there's people in the church, I imagine, who, and some of them as well, who I don't understand why they don't understand. Because, shortly after the Prop 8 thing, down there was Miller Eccles, and the church's chief pollster spoke, right? And a number of people went, and afterwards I went with them to get a dessert afterwards. And all of them voted for Obama. And all of them, some of them, they're all educated. Some of them actually come from a Sunstone tradition. And, didn't logically, actually. And they all were saying, and so I just had to be quiet, they were all saying how wonderful it was that we won. And
I go to Eccles?
Yeah.
I was at the Season Bird just last Saturday.
And they weren't giving any reasons why they thought that yes on eight was the right answer, the right position to take theologically or anything. It's just that was our position. We won, and one of them had spent a lot of time working on it. Although he said he wouldn't do it again, and he figures the trend is that the next time we'll lose, but he doesn't care anymore because he spent too much time on yes on eight. But there was nothing in there. I'm sitting there thinking, well, there's that DNC 134 section. There's all these things that never got discussed in church. And these are the people that I've known a long time. They should discuss it. And they didn't. It was like there was nothing there. I still, to this day, don't know how to explain why they were at that position. There was no defense for why they took the yes on any position. And it wasn't because they blindly followed them. I just didn't get it. I don't know how to explain it.
I know some of these people. I mean, we should let everyone in the, that kind of question shouldn't just be to me. That, anyone in the room should feel welcome to.
I'm curious as to why you think there's a space there where people talk to each other, because it's been such a divisive issue that, I'm having a hard time talking to my friends who are in the church and for yes on it.
Well, I think the reason that there's
also, I was at the temple, LA temple, by the way, at this protest.
Well, here's the thing, because
I didn't deface the temple.
You're the one.
No, I didn't. But I just, because I worked very hard against the there's so much anger in it. What space are you talking about?
I'm talking about two. I think I would describe it as two spaces. One, I know that at official leadership levels, both outside of the church and inside the church, Prop 8 was a very exhausting battle. It took too much time. It took too many resources. It took too much money on both sides. And that exhaustion, and also that exhaustion is one factor. Another factor is that, like in Los Angeles, for instance, a lot of the prominent religious leaders in LA, who I've fortunately had the good opportunity to get to know over the past 6 months, were sort of like, well, who are the Mormons? Like, we've never really seen them in such a big way before. Well, who are they? What are they doing? So there's some curiosity there. The other reason I think there's a space for dialogue is because we've reached the moment of impossibility. You know, and this is like another place where I rely on continental theory. Like, you know, someone like Jacques Derrida would say that, like, the moment at which you are at the impossible impasse is the moment where true opportunities arise. And I buy that. You're not going to be able to reconcile things in a simple or easy way, or even a way you would expect. But when you face the impossible, that's where you have the opportunity. And I think that I'm not alone in thinking that way. There's people, again, it's like, you know, I have sort of an inside view of the religious leadership of Los Angeles and also of the equality movement. I was privileged to be able to attend the leadership meeting that happened at All Saints in January, where faith-based and gay groups from across the country came together. So we were in the room with the Human Rights Campaign and with a number of other very large foundations, and then leaders from all over the country. And there's like 40 of us sitting in this giant circle in All Saints talking about, well, what happens next, you know? And one of the things that came up was you know, more dialogue.
Was it difficult for you to come out as a
to come out as a Mormon? No, well, that's the great thing. I mean, for me, everywhere I went, and I was identified as a Mormon, and people were like, "That's fantastic! You're a Mormon!" Like, I've never gotten such a warm response as a Mormon that I had in these circles. You know, I mean, I spoke at Join the Impact rally after the election, and when I identify myself as a Mormon, I had to, the applause and the roar from the crowd was so shocking, you know. But I think they were getting a message that someone was listening.